You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. New episodes drop every weekday, so listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.
You care about your money. Of course you do. So, why aren't you listening to SoFi Daily? This podcast will keep you updated on the latest news in the stock market and how it could impact your financial life. Stay on top of what's happening. Listen to SoFi Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. That's SoFi Daily, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Janice Torres, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast.
It was never that we were unstable. When my father died, he had a small life insurance policy, and my mom was just finishing grad school. She was lucky to have a job waiting for her. But it was the 1980s, and at that time, my mom was not assured a place in corporate America, nor the leeway to explain that she had three young kids at home that needed to be tended to. We were by no means on the edge, but one more tragedy might have sent us over. We often talk about earning, investing, saving, and budgeting here on the podcast. But if you find yourself underestimated, unlucky, or by any means on the margin, what you really ought to be thinking about is risk mitigation. My guest today in her upcoming book uses the F word, which I'm going to replace for this podcast with the word mess. How do you become unmesswithable? Janice Torres is a creator and host of the award-winning personal finance podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. Her highly anticipated book, Financially Lit, releases on April 30th, 2024. Janice Torres, welcome to Earn and Invest. Let's go back to the beginning. Growing up, what did you dream that success looked like? And how did you eventually realize that that was all wrong?
I think, like a lot of first generation kids who were the first to go to school, get a good job, that was my definition of success. I saw my parents struggle financially up until I was in high school. And I always saw them struggling to keep careers, make enough money. And for me, I wanted the complete opposite. So I knew I wanted to study something that was going to pay me a lot of money. Definitely college was just not an option. It was like a must. And I thought I would be happy getting to a corporate career, making six figures, getting the pension, buying the house, getting married, all of those things that we're told are marks of success in adulthood. And I found myself checking off all of these boxes and becoming progressively less and less satisfied with my life.
Traditionally, or I shouldn't say traditionally, I would say nowadays, a lot of us look at entrepreneurship as the path to success. Growing up, that's not exactly what was modeled for you. Tell me about how you saw entrepreneurs as a kid.
Yeah, entrepreneurship for me was seen as something you did because you had no other option. I saw it as something that folks who either didn't have traditional education, maybe they had to drop out of the education system early, maybe they had legal issues. It was just not something that you did because it was the path to wealth. It was the path to making a living when you had no other options. And a great example of this was my grandmother. She had a third grade education. And so she had no other option but to use entrepreneurship as her way of surviving. She actually raised my father and six other children with that third grade education. And she opened a little bodega or a little corner store on the first floor of her home in Puerto Rico. And she put two kids through college. She bought a home. She provided for children. And so I saw that as you did that because you had no other choice. So this idea of entrepreneurship to build wealth is a very new concept, not just for me, but to a lot of folks in my community as a Latina.
So let's talk about how specifically for you that switched. So you're living the life, you're in corporate America, you're starting to realize that maybe that isn't feeling as powerful as you thought. You were already dissatisfied and you happened to get fired. How did you make that switch to start looking at entrepreneurship as possibly the more powerful route?
Well, I definitely have to credit the FIRE movement. So around the time that I started my entrepreneurial career, this is back in 2013, I knew I wanted something that was leaning towards more creativity. I was a process engineer in pharmaceuticals, in the medical industry. And so for me, that felt very regimented. There was not a lot of room for creativity. You know, when you work for a regulated industry, there's a lot of rules and regulations about what you can do. And so I wanted something that was completely outside of my professional identity. I started thinking about, like, what do I actually like to do in my free time? And I kept coming back to cooking. So I've been in the kitchen since I was 11. My mom showed me how to cook to help her manage the household. And it was always a place for me that felt very natural to be. It felt like I could almost be an artist, right? I could just come up with new recipes, use ingredients as my tools. And so I loved that whole, you know, aspect of my life. And I had discovered content creation around that time. So blogging was starting to become a thing. I realized there was food bloggers who were creating these careers, sharing recipes online. And so I was really inspired by that. I started my own blog, Delish Delights, in 2013, about mid-2013. And by 2014, it was becoming something I was really excited about, but I wasn't really sure how I was going to turn it into a business yet. Until I ended up getting fired in January of 2014, got a 3-month severance, and took the opportunity, instead of rushing back to finding another career, I took that break to really educate myself on the business of content creation and blogging. So I spent some time on YouTube, on Google. I took a course at a local culinary school. They were starting to teach the business of blogging. And so for me, that was like the first inkling that there's a different way out here to make money. And you can actually be excited about it and actually do something that you're passionate about. And then I'm doing this in concurrence with, you know, again, still following a lot of these things, these prescriptive things that I should be doing. I ended up buying a house in 2016, because that's what you do when you're a successful adult. And that for me was another moment where I realized a lot of these narratives that I was told about what success looks like are not resonating with me. I hated being a homeowner. I wanted out. It felt like another thing that was going to now tie me to this career that I didn't enjoy. And so I was basically in a place where I wanted to restart. I wanted to restart my career. I wanted to redo adulthood. And I found myself Googling, how do you quit your job? And I find out about the FIRE movement. And I hear about folks who are pursuing passion projects and have retired early from their careers and are using money as a tool to give themselves more freedom. And that for me was the shift for looking at entrepreneurship, not as a way of making a means to an end because you had no other choice. It was an opportunity for you to create this career that you're super excited about and that can actually potentially accelerate your path to freedom, which I think most of us want.
As I was saying in the introduction, you use the F word. I'm substituting. I'm saying unmesswithable. But you use the F word, which is very funny and fitting for the book. But what we're really talking about, I feel like, is risk mitigation.
Yeah.
And it begs the question then, why does the traditional path not get this right, especially for Latina women? Why is going to corporate America and the house and the job and being an employee, the things that you grew up thinking were ideal, why is that not good for risk mitigation?
Well, I think we have to realize that when we're sold this idea of the American dream, which is what we're talking about, right? Go to school, get a good job, buy a house, white picket fence, 2.5 kids. Latinas and people of color in general are being asked to pursue this American dream with half the budget. Okay. So when we look at the pay disparity between Latina women and white men, it's almost 50% difference. So for us to try to think that we can achieve these things, these grandiose things that we're being told by like the mainstream talking heads in the personal finance world of just don't get into debt and, you know, try harder, work harder, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It's very tone deaf when you think about all of the things that are stacked against us as different members of a different community who just don't have the same access to resources, privilege, education, etc. Now, I'm a big believer that we do have a lot of potential within ourselves to change our circumstances, but we can't ignore the systemic things that are holding us back as a community. So when we ask people of color to build wealth, to invest, we have to take into account representation in the financial industry with our community is almost non-existent. I think it's less than 3% of CFPs are Latino. So just think about professionals. There's not even professionals to serve us as a community, to give us the information, to give us the confidence to make all these decisions that are very risky, that are, especially when you don't understand them. And so I think that's why it's so important to add that cultural context, that lens of understanding that we have different starting points. We have different traumas that we're bringing from generations of our families. And those things can really complicate these strategic steps that we're being told to follow, but with no context.
So it's not that if you go into entrepreneurship, you are not going to feel at some point effects of race and gender, but clearly in corporate America, the numbers are huge, right? You mentioned Absolutely. The pay gap, et cetera. Whereas as an entrepreneur, you have a little bit more say over how that goes. So you introduce us to the 8 steps to being financially, and again, my word, unmesswithable. And I want to break these down a little bit. Well, first you say that your mission is to make fellow women of color financially unmesswithable. What does that actually mean broadly? Like, what do you, and again, you use the F word, but what do we mean by that specifically?
I want you to feel like no matter what comes your way, money is not going to be the obstacle for you. You know, so if you're in a position where you have a boss who is mistreating you, you find out you're being underpaid, you understand that there's no prospects of growth in this career, that you're not stuck there because that's your only way of earning money. Or if you find yourself in an abusive relationship where your partner's trying to control you and you want to get out, that is not going to be the thing that keeps you there. It's not going to be the money, because you're going to have your own emergency fund. You're going to have access to your own resources. So I just really want women to be in a place where they are empowered to become their most fully expressed selves and learn how to use money in that way.
All right. So let's talk about step one. You didn't number them, but I am. So this is step one to be financially unmesswithable. You say you have to be moved beyond the scarcity mindset and invite abundance into your life at all times. There's no question. Like, any of us would say, yes, this is true. Help us understand what those words specifically mean. Because there's a lot of people who are like, this isn't working.
Yeah.
And I know I have to think more abundantly, but what does that look like on the ground?
Well, I think for a lot of folks, especially ones who are already part of my community, this aspect of representation, of actually being able to see an example of what it is that you can accomplish, is such a powerful mindset shift, right? I talk about in the book how, as Latinas, we're basically given the idea that unless you want to become an actress or a singer, like, there's no other path to wealth, right? We have folks like Jennifer Lopez and, you know, Cardi B as examples of like folks who made it out. And I'm just like, well, there has to be like normal Latina wealthy women who are owning real estate and starting businesses. Like, who's the millionaire next door whose last name happens to be like Sanchez or Gonzalez? And so when you hear people like me talk about, you know, you can build 6-7-figure businesses, you can invest your way to financial independence, just seeing somebody who comes from your community, who has your lived experience, is so powerful. And that's why I feel like it's my obligation to introduce so many different folks in my community who are also doing this, because that representation is a big, big part of how folks start to believe, you know what, if she can do it, I can do it too.
The modeling is so important when you talk about scarcity versus abundance. And I'm really very much reminded of your views of entrepreneurship. How when you are surrounded by people who are using entrepreneurship as a fallback when nothing else worked, versus today where you're surrounded by entrepreneurs who are these higher income earners who are kind of really building wealth, it's a very different modeling. And I think it really shows that difference between scarcity and abundance.
Absolutely.
So step two, you have a clear vision of your overall financial picture and your game plan for hitting all of your goals. This always interests me, and I get stuck between mindset versus tactics, because I feel like the novice believes that the tactics are the difficult part. But I think step two really talks to the mindset. Tell me about your experiences. Is it changing our minds that's so important, or is it learning how to do the specific steps?
I think it's actually learning how to get uncomfortable with the information that you're going to find once you start getting real with your money. And I will say, the first time that I calculated my net worth, I was devastated because I
was
found-
it negative?
It was negative hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I'm like, how did that, what does this mean? I'm going to become a pauper. You know, I'm going to be just struggling to make it, make things, you know, work for the rest of my life. It's just, it's a startling thing to confront your financial situation. And I think what happens to a lot of people is that's the point where they stop. They're just like, well, this is pointless. I'm in $100,000 of student loan debt. I'm never going to be able to get out of this. Nothing's ever going to change for me. And you have to feel the feelings and then do something about it. So for me, that moment of clarity was everything that I needed to start to understand, okay, this is where I owe money. This is what I'm going to prioritize. This is my most expensive debt. This is how much I'm making. I have a side hustle over here. Instead of just letting that money disappear on frivolous stuff, let me redirect it. I'm going to put this now towards this debt because now I can see what's happening. And then as you're using, you know, a net worth tracker tool, I love the Empower tool, used to be Personal Capital. When I would watch the progress of that net worth number now going more and more positive, that for me was the psychological motivation that I needed to continue.
Yeah, it's interesting how the tactics follow once the mindset changes.
Absolutely.
Those things you think are insurmountable become reasonable once your brain wraps itself around them.
Yeah.
Step three of becoming financially unmesswithable: you're investing in your future while living your best mother effing life now. This sounds funny, but it's a very big, important question. What I really think we're talking about is how to choose between YOLO, you only live once, hey, let's do it now while we can, while we're young and alive, and deferred gratification, right? Having enough money saved up so you can manage those bumps or you can retire one day. How do we parse that out? How do we put YOLO in its correct place and yet still plan for the future?
Yeah, that's one of the things that didn't really sit well with me when I first discovered the financial independence movement, of just this idea of extreme frugality and scarcity to then live some sort of more balanced life. That for me just felt like, why would I want to go back to what I experienced as a kid? You know, it's like, why do I want to go back to being an intentional broke college student who's like, you know, living between paying off this credit card to pay that credit card and making $5.15 an hour working as a desk assistant? Like, this is not what I'm trying to do. So for me, it's more about, and Ramit talks about this a lot, is this idea of like identifying your rich life or values-based spending, where you're really just putting your money towards the things that actually matter to you. I don't think enough people ask themselves questions like, am I actually doing this because I want to, versus this is some script or some narrative that I've been fed that I should do? And for me, a perfect example was buying the home. I thought renting is stupid. You're making someone else money. You're never going to get wealthy if you keep renting. And I did it. And I even bought a duplex so I could be a landlord, because that's even more successful, right? And I realized I don't want to deal with the issues that come with being a landlord. I'm not particularly handy, so anything that breaks, I'm going to have to pay someone a lot more money to fix it. And I didn't want to share a home with someone else because I could hear them having arguments. It was just a lot that I didn't realize about my own personality that was not conducive to this decision that I was told by everyone was a good decision and that it was always going to be a smart thing to do. I ended up losing money when I sold the house. I sold it at a loss. So like, the whole process for me was just an unlearning of all the scripts. And I had to come back to myself and realize I actually love the flexibility of being a renter. I love being able to just pick a place, move in, give 30 days notice, leave. If I get bored, if I don't like the neighborhood, if I want to change my job, there's so much freedom that comes with my lifestyle now. And it's because I stopped listening to everybody else telling me what I should want and started putting my money towards the things that I actually do want and that are actually aligned with the life that I want to live.
Yeah, this idea of co-opting other people's value system or version of success, whereas you found it didn't fit you.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what does and doesn't fit other people, which brings us to step four. You say you're making it rain with multiple income streams because ain't nobody got time to leave your financial security in the hands of an employer. This gets into side hustles. And I know that in our community, especially people interested in personal finance and definitely financial independence, side hustles are a big thing. Yeah. But I also know outside of us, there are a lot of people who like kind of going to their 9-to-5. And this idea of creating a new revenue stream just isn't exciting to them. How important is this? Should everybody have a side hustle?
I think everyone needs to have some other way of making money, because even the safe careers that we were told would never go away are things that we saw disappear during the pandemic, or things that we're seeing potentially be at risk now with AI and just the rapid development of our world and technology and the way that all of that coexists. So I learned the hard way back in January 2014 when I was laid off, how quickly your entire financial situation can change. I walked into work and 30 minutes later, I had no job. You know, it's not like we have regulations in this country that give you 3 months notice so you can prepare. You know, there's other parts of the world where there's a little bit more structure that goes with protecting workers, but we're not in that place. And so for me, I'm like, I have to be my own safety net. I have to be my own security. And so if you don't have the capacity or the desire to start a side hustle, I think that means you definitely need to be investing. You definitely need to be at least creating some sort of passive income revenue through the stock market. Maybe you decide you want to own some real estate and use that as an additional source of income. Maybe you decide you want to invest in someone else's business so you don't have to deal with everything that comes with running a business, but you can, you know, make some money off of that. Or maybe you just decide to build a really big emergency fund, something that's a couple years worth of your expenses, so that in the event that you do find yourself in that period of necessary and unwilling transition, you don't have to be desperate to the situation. You don't have to take the first job that comes along, or you don't have to sell your house and downsize and completely disrupt you and potentially your family's life because you just didn't have a plan for something that's inevitably going to happen to most of us.
We are talking to Janice Torres. She is the creator and host of the award-winning personal finance podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. And we are talking the 8 steps to being financially unmesswithable. We're going to take a short break. I'm Doc G, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast. This episode is brought to you by Range Rover Sport. Range Rover Sport leads by example. With a visceral, uncompromising, and dramatic feel, this car helps you rise to the occasion. How does it do that? Range Rover Sport has powerful on-road performance and commanding all-terrain capability by combining assertiveness with signature Range Rover refinement. This is the car that redefines sporting luxury. The new Range Rover Sport features advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification, purposeful cockpit-like driving position, and award-winning Pivi Pro infotainment is at the heart of the experience and provides intuitive control of the vehicle systems. Design your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. Once again, explore and build your Range Rover Sport at LandRoverUSA.com. That's LandRoverUSA.com. Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever, and that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenues, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals such as job changes or which accounts you should prioritize, and shows you hidden allies so you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/earn. That is linkedin.com/EARN for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/earn and get started. We are back with Janice Torres. She is the author of the book Financially Lit, which releases on April 30th, 2024. And we are talking about the 8 steps to being financially unmesswithable. Step 1 is you have moved beyond a scarcity mindset. Step 2 is you have a clear vision of your overall financial picture. Step 3 is you investing in your future. Step 4 is you're making it rain with multiple income streams. Which brings us to step 5, you're financially independent such that your spirit cannot be irked by a toxic boss or someone's dusty ass son. I love the language here. I can just see the dusty ass son in my mind. How do you define financial independence? I mean, I've heard financial independence defined so many different ways by so many different people. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's super simple. It's you have your own money and you have control over it. So for me, especially as a woman who has experienced divorce, it was transformative for me to be in a position where I could move out of the home, where I didn't have to worry about how I was going to keep a roof over my head or how I was going to now live this life as a single woman that has all these bills that I was splitting with a partner that now I'm responsible for myself. So financial independence for me is very much just having access to the resources that you need in order to make sure that nothing around you can disturb you, can, you know, tip you off into a place where now you are kind of a victim of your circumstances, if you will.
So in a sense, it's not necessarily a number. It's definitely more of a mindset.
Absolutely.
We talked about step 5, financial independence. Step 6 goes a little bit further. You say you know how to negotiate pay raises, client contacts, bills, and interest rates like it's your business because it is. Do we tend to give up too easily? I mean, I see this often that we are afraid to value ourselves appropriately. Why do we do this?
Well, speaking from the context of being a woman in the workforce, I was surprised in my research when I found that 60% of women don't even negotiate their salaries when they take on a job. And so for me, I think there's a lot of things at play. I think absolutely culturally, we are taught as women to not really rock the boat. You know, there's this narrative of if a woman's assertive, she's bitchy. But if a man is assertive, you know, he's a leader. So I think there's a lot of these narratives that do not serve women that make us afraid to advocate for ourselves because of the way that we'll be perceived. But I think it's also realizing that a lot of us are just not taught this. And negotiation is a skill set, the same way that learning how to make money is a skill set. And so I like to tell folks, just start becoming your own advocate. And it doesn't have to be that you try and negotiate a $100,000 pay raise at your job on day one. It can be that you start to question when the cable company says, hey, we're going to raise your rate by $20 a month. You know, something as simple as hopping on the phone and asking them, well, why is that happening? Well, I don't agree with that. I'm going to switch to another provider. You'd be surprised how many times people are willing to just meet you where you are if you ask. And I think I can definitely credit my father. He always had this saying that he would share with me that said, the squeaky wheel is the one that gets the oil. And so you have to learn how to make some noise if you want people to care about what you're saying and to, you know, give you the attention that you deserve.
You mentioned two things there. One is self-advocacy and the other is perception. In other words, being the squeaky wheel. Do you think perception is better? Is society accepting women who speak up more now than, let's say, 10 years ago or when you remember as a kid seeing people around you in the business world?
Absolutely. I think we can definitely credit that to the various social movements that have come about in the last 10 years where, you know, women are definitely being given the permission to speak up and stand up for what they believe in. But I think as a society, we've also had to come to realize that there are so many different perspectives. There are so many different narratives in the world that we can't just hold one as the end all be all. And that's why I'm so happy about the fact that even in our own personal finance community, there is such a vast array of voices that were not present in the past that are really giving sort of a holistic, nuanced approach to the conversations around money while taking into account all of the different, you know, intersections that folks have to navigate when we are talking about the way we interact with money.
Yeah, I have to say and give the financial independence space some credit. The number of new and I would almost say exalted voices that aren't the typical ones have grown so much in the last 5 years that honestly, it's just been a radical change. And I think financial independence, at least that community, has really embraced the fact that everyone's finances are slightly different. And therefore, all those extra voices, not only are we speaking to people who have then the same experience as us when we can find someone who looks like us in this community, but I'll tell you, as a white male kind of from that traditional background, I realize how much I was missing in my financial education that I now am learning by hearing the voices of people who look and sound different than me. And I had no idea that that was absent from the conversation until I started seeing producers who frankly didn't look or sound like me.
Yeah. Yeah. It's important for us to really just have that lens of cultural competency when we talk about these things.
So back to our steps of being financially unmesswithable. Step 7, you are a generational wealth building badass who's changing the legacy of your family with the power of money. I always get stuck on this one. I'm always in between on generational wealth because I never know whether I should be creating this huge amount of wealth to pass on, or I should really be allowing my children to do it for themselves. So talk about generational wealth and why you felt it important to add into this list.
Yeah, I think when you find yourself in my position as kind of the catalyst of change, if you will, in your family, where you are the first to be going to college, the first to really, you know, make more money than your family has been able to previously, and maybe you're even raising children, there's a lot of pressure that we're facing as sort of this sandwich generation where we're trying to figure out how do we support our elders while also giving our children sort of a leg up that we didn't have growing up. So I think for my community, there's kind of just an inherent sense of community that comes with being Latino. We're very much used to this idea of multi-generational households, of not letting anyone go hungry, this individualistic nature of the personal finance conversation that is typical in America is just not really aligned with like who we are and how we operate. And I think a lot of communities of color can relate to that as well. You know, you see folks from different parts of the world that you don't move out of your parents' house until you get married. And then when your parents get old, they move in with you. And this is all just very normal part of the conversation. So I thought it was important to talk about the aspects of building generational wealth because it's such a prevalent conversation for us. And I also want folks to do it in a way that is not going to sabotage your own individual situation. So one of the concepts that I talk about in the book is this idea of a family emergency fund, where you're actually creating a separate pool of money so that when your family has an emergency, you know how much support you can extend because you've earmarked that specifically for that purpose, right? And so when you do things like that, you put yourself in a position where you can be that person that helps, but you can also put some boundaries around that help so you don't end up becoming just an endless supply of money that then is going to sabotage your own future self.
So last but not least, step 8, you have a trusted team of professionals in your back pocket who are helping you achieve rich Tia status. Talk to me about DIY, because that's another big thing that we really believe in sometimes in the financial independence space, and certainly a little bit in the personal finance space, this idea that if you can do it yourself, you should save the money, you should learn. Contrast that to the idea of having the right professionals supporting you.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of, for me, I had to realize I'm not ever going to be the smartest person in the room when it comes to money. You know, this is all something that I'm navigating without any resources from like a family perspective of somebody that I can go and ask, hey, mom, like, how do I create an estate plan? Or, hey, how do I do a Roth conversion? You know, like, I'm figuring all of this out by myself. And yes, there are things you can do. You can absolutely read a ton of amazing books, listen to a ton of incredible podcasts and you know, read a bunch of blogs. But at some point, you're going to meet a part of your financial situation that you are just not qualified to navigate on your own, nor do I recommend doing so. As a business owner, I know I'm not about to memorize the IRS tax code. but I want to make sure that I'm doing it right. And so it's important for me to work with a CPA, with a bookkeeper, with folks who are just experts in this arena so that I can continue to do what my genius is, which is creating content and serving my community. And I don't have to worry about that aspect of the business. As someone who is buying real estate and building wealth, I want to make sure that I'm putting guardrails in place to either transfer that wealth, protect it, shield it from lawsuits, all these types of things that can happen. And so working with someone who is, you know, an attorney who can help you with an estate plan, who can help you navigate conversations around prenups if you're getting married, there's just so many things that can affect your money. And I think it's important to have trusted folks in your corner for when you do encounter those situations where you just don't feel qualified to make an educated decision. And there's a lot riding on that decision.
So we've been talking about the 8 steps to becoming financially unmesswithable. There are a lot of people listening right now who might be at the beginning of the journey. How long does this take? Like, when do you go from at risk to being unmesswithable?
Well, I like to tell folks that this entire journey is a marathon and not a sprint. So you're never going to be perfect in all aspects of your money. There are going to be things that come up and you're going to make mistakes, especially if you're navigating this world, you know, largely by yourself. So I think it definitely gets to a point where you feel more confidence, where you start to understand what the right questions are to ask, or if you don't, you know where to go to find these answers. But I don't know if there's a final destination because things change so much, right? We can even look at things like now we're dealing with cryptocurrency and NFTs, and there's always going to be something else. So I think as long as you embrace this idea of being a perpetual learner and are okay with just becoming a student of something you don't understand, that is going to put you in a position where you really are unmessable with, because you're going to trust your instincts, you're going to know how to do your due diligence, and you're going to be in a position where even if you're not 100% sure, you know somewhat of how to get on the right path, or you know how to find folks who can guide you along the way.
We mentioned this idea that there isn't a clear destination, right? You're always growing. There's no necessarily finish line. Let's look at the opposite side at the beginning. What's a good first step? They're reading your book. They're like, okay, I need to get good with money. I'm not good with money currently. I want to be unmesswithable. How do I begin? And specifically, is the beginning different for women or Latinas than it would be for anyone?
I don't think it is. I think honestly, the first most important thing we need to do is just really get real about our current situation. You know, it's like going on a diet, but not measuring yourself on day one. So you don't actually know any progress that you've made on day 60 because you had no idea what your starting weight was, right? So I think it's just important to get real with your money. Accept the situation for what it is, but understand that it is absolutely changeable. Understand that that first step of understanding what's going on is the first step. It's not the end. It's not the, you know, this is my life. Woe is me. I'm a victim to my circumstance. Nothing's ever going to change. That's not where you want to land. You want to land in the place where, okay, now I know everything that's going on. Now I can start to create a tactical plan, whether that is I need to make more money, I need to pay off this debt, I need to downsize my house. Whatever it is that you've come to the conclusion that's going to help you, you need to know your starting point. And I think it's also important to lean into learning about the mental health aspect of money. So understanding what are those narratives that you have? Where did they come from? Did you see money as a stressful thing growing up? Was it something that you saw your parents fight about or potentially get divorced over? If you have those traumas, you have to work with someone, whether that's a therapist, a financial coach that specializes in financial trauma, something. You're going to need some level of support to navigate that, because you're going to encounter a lot of feelings when it comes to money. And that's important to make a plan for how you're going to navigate those as well.
Yeah, it's a good point. And even people I know who feel like they have a good relationship with money often still have to unwind some of those narratives of childhood. It's a complex subject.
Yeah.
There are some people, I imagine, who are in corporate America right now, and they plan to stay there. How hopeful are you that the racial and wealth gaps, the racial and gender gaps, are going to improve? Like, do you see this improving in the future?
Well, according to my research, it's going to take 136 years to bridge that wage gap.
Wow.
So 136
if we years.
Go with that information, we cannot afford to wait. So honestly, I do think that one of the most powerful solutions is for more people of color to become entrepreneurs. Because when we can reconfigure the system so that we are kind of changing it from within as top-down leaders, we can create new cultures in our companies, we can pay our workers an equal wage, we can provide benefits that have not been available to folks in the past. You know, like all of the people who work for me are people of color. And like that for me is sort of a value or mission statement of my company. I just want to be someone who is able to provide jobs to people of color. That's important to me as a CEO. And so I think the more folks that we have who are able to create companies with different cultures, who are able to, like I said, change the system from within, I think that's going to get us to a faster place than just kind of waiting around for the system that's currently in place to fix itself. And I also do think it's going to require us to become more politically involved, to really start asking questions of our elected officials, to see like where their heads are at and how much they actually care about this issue, because it's a multifaceted problem that's going to require both a systemic change, but also individual change. And, you know, it's I wish it was simpler than that, but change from within is how I see it as the fastest route to change.
Well, Janice, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today. As we've been joking, I changed the F word to say unmesswithable. But I can't help but thinking about that figure you just gave us, 136 years to erase the racial and gender wealth gap. What we're really talking about is risk mitigation. And if you were waiting around for corporate America or even our politicians to fix the situation, you're going to be waiting for a long time. And so what I love about the 8 steps that you provide is you give it a way for people to take steps now to protect themselves and create the financial framework and life that they want. I want to end this episode the way we end every episode, by asking you what is up next in your life and where we can find you. Talk to me about Financially Lit. When is it coming out and where can people find it?
Yes. So I am organizing a book tour at the moment, and we're going to be stopping across a bunch of different cities in the United States. You can find out all the details and order the book and the audiobook at financiallylitbook.com, and it comes out April 30th.
And if people want to ask you questions directly, is that the best place to go?
You can follow me on social media at Yo Quiero Dinero Podcast. I'm on Instagram, TikTok, everywhere else you hang out on social media. And you can also tune into my podcast wherever you listen to the Earn and Invest podcast.
Well, the book is Financially Lit. Janice Torres, thank you so much for coming on Earn and Invest today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's a wrap.
Earn and Invest is now part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to this show as well as other fine podcasts.
I've been thinking a lot lately about this idea of whether the FIRE movement has lost its soul. So I'm talking about financial independence, retire early. A lot of us got into the FIRE movement because, frankly, we like to optimize our finances. We like to make money. We like to spreadsheet. We like to spend a lot of time talking about things like safe withdrawal rates and how to optimize our retirement life to have as much as possible, and how to be frugal, and how to win at business and entrepreneurship, etc. Now, I've often heard the complaint by a lot of people that the core of what was FIRE, all this optimization and money management and entrepreneurship, has been replaced by something that a lot of people don't like. And what we're talking about is lifestyle design. This is the idea that instead of worrying about money and trying to optimize our money, ultimately we want to get our money right quickly so that we can then move on and talk about living our best lives. Yes, this encompasses all those things I love to talk about, like purpose and meaning. In other words, a lot of the conversation has evolved, and we see this throughout the FIRE movement because we've heard of SloFi and CoastFi, and if you go to any of these big conferences that have to do with financial independence, whether it's a smaller one like Camp FIRE or a bigger one like Economy, what you'll see is people don't spend a lot of time talking about money anymore. They really talk about living their best life, doing the things they want to do, and optimizing for happiness, not for income, not for savings, not for investment returns. And a lot of people question whether it is right that the movement has moved in this direction. And on some level, it doesn't matter. The movement has moved in this direction whether we wanted it to or not. That is what's happening. What generally happens with movements is you have the older group of creators who begin with the basic ideas, but then as time goes on, newer creators come onto the scene, whether that be bloggers or podcasters or writers, and they move the ball forward. Their ideas change, they optimize in new ways, they come to the fore with new philosophies. And all of this changes the movement from what it began to what it is to become. And so we can argue as much as we want about whether we've sold out on the basic ideas of what financial independence is or not. But the truth of the matter is, the narrative has moved on. I guess the bigger question, too, is should it? While I, just as much as the next person, love to talk about spreadsheets, I love to talk about optimization, I can argue till my face is blue about what the best safe withdrawal rate is. The truth of the matter is, most people are kind of tired about talking about these things. Yes, it's true. When you first go down the rabbit hole and you first learn about financial independence, those are all the things you want to talk about. But once you've been in this space for a long time, you stop caring as much about the numbers. Dare I say, when you've been financially independent for quite a while, you stop worrying about the bank accounts and the returns and the optimization. That's what I've found. So I've been in this community long enough to see people who've been doing this for 5, 10, 15 years. And the truth of the matter is, most of them don't want to talk about investing anymore. Most of them don't want to talk about safe withdrawal rates anymore. What they're really trying to do is use all that they learned at the beginning of this journey and then use it to live better, more fulfilling lives. So it's true, on this podcast and other places, you'll hear us talk less and less about money and more about lifestyle design. And ultimately, I think it's a natural progression. And that's where I think a lot of us are, those who are creating content, those who have been through this long enough. And so I think there's still going to be some hardcore people who want to hash out the numbers and talk about finances specifically ad nauseum. But the rest of the movement is moving on to newer, better, and hopefully greater things. And so I apologize for those who bought into the initial messages, who loved the first podcast episodes, who were all about optimizing their finances and now are feeling left out when that's not what most of us want to talk about anymore. But I think all healthy movements evolve. And this is what evolution looks like here in the FIRE movement. And this is what you'll see on Earn and Invest. All right, I leave things running just for a moment to catch kind of any of our after show.
Sure.
I love it. I mean, I think every step there is so important. And as you and I were talking about in the break, I can't cover everything in the book, and there's a lot of really great stuff in the book. But what I love about that list is that's the beginning of what you expound on through the rest of your chapters.
Right.
And so it's like this really great introduction of where are we going in this book. And it touches on so many important financial privileges that I knew that when I saw that kind of list at the beginning of the book, I'm like, this is what we need to talk about.
That's great.
It's kind of cool. And I know I felt this when I wrote a book, too. It's like, it feels like everything coalesces and everything you've learned up to this point. Anything that really surprised you? Like when you wrote the book, were there any things either that clicked that were kind of in the back but hadn't clicked before? Any ideas that surprised you that you didn't know were bubbling up?
You know what's funny? I was reading the book the other day. I got some advanced reader copies and I'm like, wow, I'm very impressed by myself just putting together this body of work. And it just makes me think about my own journey. When I got my book deal, I was still married. And so I actually navigated a divorce while writing this book. And so chapter 9, where we're talking about love and money, that wasn't even a part of the original proposal. So it's almost like I've had to have this lived experience and have all these different things happen to me personally and professionally to just be in a place to even be able to put this together. And so it's just been sort of cathartic, I would say, to go through all of the childhood memories, relive my career, relive all these personal decisions that have led me to where I am today. And my hope is that this book becomes the book that someone gets when they graduate from high school, and it kind of guides them throughout their adult life. I really wish I'd had that kind of resource, and I'm hoping that the next generation of women really do feel empowered in a way that, you know, others in the past have not.
Yeah, my friend Jillian Johnsrud has said this multiple times, and it reminds me of this idea of, you know, when you're doing something like what you're doing, which is writing a book, it really feels like you're birthing it, right? You're creating it, you're building it, you're growing it. And then you release it into the world, and all of a sudden you completely lose control of it. It becomes everyone else's and not yours. And it's an interesting feeling, I think, when you get to that point, which you're getting to. And I think hopefully you'll enjoy it quite a bit. And as it goes out in the world and gets into people's hands and affects them, you'll realize all that work was worth it, and a definite labor of love.
Absolutely. We talk about legacy, right? The generational wealth for me is being able to put it in this book and hopefully instill some financial literacy in people long after I'm not here anymore.
Yeah, we didn't talk about it specifically, but we always talk about generational wealth when we are considering things like real estate and bank accounts and that kind of stuff. But the generational knowledge and kind of that generational growth of your family, kids, cousins, nephews, all of them kind of seeing you be authentic and embrace what you've learned and share it, creates its own new sense of generational wealth that isn't tied to bank accounts, but it's that kind of passing on of knowledge, which I think is so powerful.
It's so true. I was talking to my dad, he's reading the book, and he's like, you know, you can actually see the progress of our family through this book when you tell the stories about your grandmother and your mom and I and kind of where you are today. So he's just like really excited to see what comes of it for future generations of our family and beyond.
Yeah, it's really an evolution, and you're part of that, which is very cool.
Tech moves fast. So keep pace with the Daily Crunch podcast from TechCrunch. With new episodes every day, this podcast will give you a quick overview on everything you need and should know about startups, new tech, regulations, and more. Listen to TechCrunch Daily Crunch now, wherever you get your podcasts. That's TechCrunch Daily Crunch, wherever you get your podcasts.